Everyone to today's Clouin Internet Seminar. My name is Jean Balance. I'm coming from EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as the online session moderator. Today we'll be carrying out the CEC Preliminary Assessment and Site Inspection, or PASI, webinar series with module number 7. Module number 7 will cover conducting the SI, an overview of SI strategies and site sources, and has been sponsored by EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. In just a few moments, I'm going to turn things over to your two instructors. Today we'll be joined by Jody McCarty from Tetra Tech, as well as Therese Joya from Tetra Tech as well. Before I turn things over to your instructors today, though, I want to walk through just a few housekeeping items for our participants to make sure everyone knows how our live session will operate today. Again, with today's webinar, it will run just as the others have in the series, so you will receive a unique reminder email for each webinar in the series, and they will ultimately point you to what's known as the seminar homepage. On the homepage, you can read more about each module. You'll find links to download copies of the presentation materials, as well as the other resources that we've pulled together on the links or resources page. So we oftentimes include guidance documents, supplemental websites, as well as either exercise handouts or participant modules, as we've been using throughout this series. You'll also find contact information and bios for our instructors, as well as links to our feedback form for each session. For now, to join us for the live broadcast, you'll want to click a button that appears in the upper left-hand corner labeled Go to Seminar. Once you click that button, it'll ask you to identify yourself by name as well as the number of people at your location, and then it will successfully check you in online to our fully interactive Adobe Connect session. Just be sure when you're checking in online that you check in using the same first and last name that you did when you signed up. So let's say your name is Jennifer. If you registered under the name Jen, you'll want to be sure to check in under the name Jen. We won't find you in the system under Jennifer. When you check in, you'll be able to watch and listen throughout Adobe Connect using this live online tool. So our participants can watch as our speakers move through the presentation materials and provide some interactive demonstrations. We will also be using interactive poll questions, so you want to be sure to stay glued to your screen and vote on some of those questions when they pop up in the lower left half of your screen. If you have problems joining us online, we do have the slides available to download, and you can simply join us on the phone lines, but just let us know about those technical problems so we can work with you to troubleshoot those issues. Audio will be available online by default for all participants. You can actually listen to this entire session right through your computer speakers or a mobile device with a pair of headphones. If you have problems with the online audio, please check your local volume settings first. Sometimes it's just a matter of increasing the speaker output to get it to work. If that doesn't solve the problem, we do have toll-free call-in information for those who need it. Simply use the Q&A window in the lower right-hand corner to request it, and I'll get you the call-in number. Just know, though, if you join us on the phones, you will be placed on a global mute, and we ask that you remain globally muted to minimize background noises and other audio disruptions. As I just alluded to, there is an interactive Q&A window in the lower right corner. There's already a welcome message for me. You guys can use that question and answer box to submit your comments, questions, and to report technical problems privately at any time. We will take designated breaks, at which point I'll read off questions to our instructors so they can answer them for you, but there's no need to wait. So I encourage you to type up your questions and comments as soon as they occur to you. If you have any problems with those poll questions that we'll be posing, you can also type in your reply to the poll questions in the Q&A window in the lower right. So if you've just joined us online, go ahead and take a minute and send in a quick test message into the Q&A window. Make sure you know how that operates. Feel free to say hi, let me know what the weather's like, or just let me know how excited you are for module number 7, which will kick off in just a moment. Again, we will be recording today's broadcast, as we have with the others in the series. If you are missing links for some of the other modules, I do have links to replay modules 1 through 6. So if you need any of those links, feel free to use the Q&A window to let me know. We will also send confirmation emails once each module has been posted. And then, of course, you can certainly browse the nearly 600 archived Clouin seminars that we have currently available online. This is a short little screenshot you should see. Your slides will appear here on the left-hand side of your screen. There is a button in the upper right that looks like four arrows pointing in opposite corners. If you click that once, it'll make the slides bigger. You can click it a second time to shrink the slides back down, so you can control that as needed throughout today's broadcast. Along the right, you'll see our Clouin logo. You will see below that a collection of related URLs. That's where you'll find the links to our homepage, our feedback form, as well as our seminar resources. And then that interactive Q&A window here in the lower right, you can submit your comments and questions, as well as report technical problems at any time. I think that's the end of the technical reminders I have. Again, one last reminder for everybody, this is a 9-part module series. We will be issuing training certificates at the conclusion of the 9 modules, but in order to receive full credit for participating, you do need to take each one of the 9 modules. We are encouraging you to do those in numerical order, but you can do it through any combination of live online participation or replaying a recorded version. You can do them all recorded, all live, or some combination of the two. If you take any one of the series, whether it's live or replay through a recorded version, make sure you fill out the feedback form for each module. And when you fill that form out, you click a box on that form that'll send a confirmation email to you for your own records. That does greatly help us verify those who are either replaying the archived versions or participating live to help us issue those training certificates. Once we've concluded the live delivery of module number 9 and we've been able to post all 9 modules, we will send out an email to all registrants in the series reminding them of where the modules are and then give them a certain period of time to play catch-up and replay whatever modules they've missed so that we can then go through our records and start issuing training certificates to those who participated in all 9 modules. Okay, I think that's the end of all of the reminders, and Jody, I believe you've been able to join us back on.
I have, thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and now finally turn things over to our first instructor today, Jody McCarty, again, who's joining us from Tetra Tech. Jody, whenever you're ready.
All right, thank you, Jean. Welcome, everybody, to today's webinar, Module 7. At this point in the process, we've gone through our preliminary assessment and determined that we feel our site has enough information to move forward with a site inspection. So that is where we're going to get started today. As soon as I get to the correct slide, I'm sorry. So yeah, so today we're going to talk about conducting the site inspection and what we do, what our documentation is, what our final output is for the site inspection process. I think Jean is maybe trying to help me get to the right slide. I apologize, everybody.
Or maybe I can.
Hey, Jody, do you need me to click for you?
Well, I can't even. I think so, if because it's trying to, I think, load the slides again. I can see the green arrow moving.
Okay.
Yeah, I was moving it.
Okay. So, yeah, I guess if you guys don't mind going to slide one of you 7-2.
You got it. We're already there.
Okay, thank you. So we're going to look at what our goals are and then what we actually do during the site inspection, preparing for conducting the site inspection, what are the plans that we need to develop before we go out and do that, a work plan, a health and safety plan. And then while we're out there and we're collecting samples, we come up with what's called investigation-derived waste. How do we handle that at the site? And then our final output, which is the SI report. So what should be in there? We'll look at the different portions of that. And it looks like I can advance now, so we'll see how that goes. So if we move on to the next slide, the site inspection goals. Traditionally, this is the first time where we are collecting actual samples from the site. As we've mentioned before, some regions are able and do collect a limited amount of samples during the preliminary assessment stage. But typically, your first collection of samples will be during the site inspection. And what we're doing during the site inspection is we want to make sure we're collecting information and analytical information to support our decision about the site and to see if it should move on and we should start the HRS scoring process. We're also screening the information that we have and the data that we collect to see if our site needs to be placed on the NPL or does not require being placed on the MPL or any additional work or either deferred to another program. Are there any potential removal or enforcement actions that need to be taken place based on our new information? Or, again, are we providing information to help support other work, such as an RIFS, maybe something under the RCRA program. So that's what we're really looking to do is should we move forward with the site in the HRS process, or are we able to maybe help get some data that we can use in another program? So there's four basic tasks that we do during the site inspection. The first one is reviewing the information that we already have available. So again, this is looking at your preliminary assessment report that was compiled and completed. Looking at this information, this helps us move forward with our sampling plan. You know, what are we going to do when we're out in the field? Where do we need to look? Where do we need to collect data from? The second thing is you're going to put together your project teams and then develop the plans that I mentioned just a little bit earlier, the work plan, your sampling plan, your quality assurance project plan, your health and safety plan. You're putting together who you need for your team. You know, you'll have a project manager. You'll have people that are going out into the field doing the actual sampling for you. Maybe you need to subcontract some work out for, you know, particular analysis. So that'll also be in this in your plans, and then also something that you'll need to consider. Then after you've got all that put together and approved, you're going to actually go out and do the field work. This typically involves your site reconnaissance, your field sampling, health and safety monitoring. Those are all part of that process. And then like with most work, you'll prepare, you'll put all that data together, you'll evaluate it, and then you'll put together your site inspection report. And this, you know, just kind of talks about the site, the sources that you've identified and confirmed. It'll look at each one of the pathways and then what targets you have and if they're actually or potentially exposed to any hazardous substance contamination. All right, so there's a couple approaches that you can use when you're doing a site inspection. The first one is the focused site inspection, and that's really phase one. This one is a collection of a shorter amount of, or a smaller amount of samples. And really this, the focused SI is just to get the information that you need to see if there is hazardous substances at the site that are that cause an exposure to human health or the environment. Again, this is typically, you know, 12 to 20 samples. That's just a kind of a general range. It doesn't have to, you know, be that, but it most likely will not be more than, you know, more than 20 samples. And really, you're just looking at those hypotheses that were developed in the preliminary assessment. You're trying to collect data and samples to test those to see if we need to move, if we need to continue to move the site forward. And then the second phase would be your expanded site inspection. So this is where you've collected those initial samples, you have the data that says yes, it, you know, it looks like we'll have a score that's greater than 28.50. We have information that this site should move forward and be, you know, with an HRS package. So in the expanded SI, you're collecting that data that you need to complete that HRS package, to just put together a tight and concise HRS package with all the data that is necessary. This is where you're looking at any assumptions that you might have created during the PA. You're testing those and you're now confirming them, so they're no longer assumptions. You either have a yes or no. You're making sure that the hazardous substances are attributable to the site, so you're collecting samples to document and confirm that. And then you're also collecting data and samples to establish what your background concentrations are, and then any other possible data gaps that you might have. This one, you might collect a few more samples. We give a range of, you know, 25 to 30. You might do some specialized sampling or field activities, in maybe installing some monitoring wells, some air sampling, depending on what kind of sources you have or the information you need, maybe some drum sampling if possible. And then you'll want to also make sure that in this stage that you're collecting your QA/QC samples, so that, again, just to make that HRS package nice and tight and concise, you have everything that you need, so you've got your QA/QC samples to document that the proper sampling methods were used, holding times were not missed, that type of information. So our first step, again, one of our first tasks is to prepare for the SI, and one of the things we do, again, is look at that preliminary assessment report. One of the reasons that we do this, again, is to help, you know, not duplicate efforts that have already happened. So maybe there's already been some data collected. Reviewing the PA report will let you know that. It'll let you know where it was collected. Your PA report, you'll remember, this has information on what you knew at that time. So what type of waste was generated at the site? How did they dispose of it? What are the hazardous substances that you think are associated with the site or the sources that are there? What are your potential sources, and then what kind of hazardous substances did they contain? You remember each one of the pathways is discussed and talks about the targets that are affected and the different types of media that could be affected. Again, a look at the different targets, the potential targets. Do you have schools nearby? Any residential areas? Any wetlands? And then what are the sampling locations that you really need to look at for your site inspection? So, you know, according to the PA, where are areas at the site that you need to sample in order to test those hypotheses and just confirm that the site should or should not continue to move forward? So again, as I mentioned, this just helps to duplicate any efforts that have already been done, any sampling that's already been done, any documentation review that's already been conducted. Again, it also helps you look for putting together your sampling plan when you go out to do the site inspection. And then again, you're looking at those hypotheses that were developed during the PA and just making sure that they're still accurate, and how can we test those to make sure that they are, that they're sound. So another thing that we need to think about when we're preparing for the SI but we haven't gone out to the actual site yet is getting site access. You know, we can't go onto a property that's not our own property, so we need to make sure that we have been given access to go out to the site and, you know, either conduct our site recon, conduct sampling, do interviews depending on the type of site or facility that it is. So this is one of the first things that you'll want to do. You'll also want to do it, make sure that it's being done fairly early in the process, because it can take a while for access to be granted sometimes. And typically, getting legal access to a property is done by the EPA or the state that is that's involved. Now, sometimes, you know, contractor personnel can help in this, but typically it is the responsibility of either the EPA or the state to obtain that access that we work under. So there's four different types of access. We can have voluntary entry. This is obviously the preferred and is what we should, you know, what EPA and the state should try to get first. This is really where the owner agrees to let the people come on the property, and pretty much they can, you know, do whatever they want on the property, collect samples, interview people. They have access to all of the buildings, all of the property. If this is obtained verbally, then it should be immediately followed up with, you know, written agreement, so that it is in writing as well. The second kind is conditional entry. So this is where the owner has given consent for the team to enter. However, there are some limitations on it. So maybe there's a certain area of the site where they've said a person, you know, the teams can't sample or they can't go on that area. Or maybe if it is still in operation, they're restricting who they can speak to at the facility, information like this. So this one just has some conditions with it that will need to be followed. Then there's entry with a warrant. So this is where your, you know, EPA or the state is not able to get consent from the owner to enter the property, and therefore they have to get a warrant to do that. And if that is the case, and if you're working under access where you're with a warrant, then you'll just want to make sure that, you know, you and your team are following the guidelines and the restrictions that are in the warrant. So you'll want to have that reviewed and just make sure you understand it and your team understands it and knows where you can go, where you can't go, what you can do, what you can't do. And then finally, the last type is entry without a warrant. And obviously this is, you know, the last kind of entry that you want to do, but it's really for either an emergency situation or if it appears that, you know, evidence might be lost if you don't enter at that point. Should that happen, then obviously, you know, the EPA is working with their regional council, and the locals are being notified to let them know, you know, what's going on. You know, you hope that that's never the situation, and obviously, you know, safety is a big concern as well. So even, you know, no matter which type of access you have, if you do feel, you know, your safety is threatened or something is not going right, you know, just document that and leave the site and then call, you know, your contact, your client that you're working with, and just, you know, kind of explain the situation, and then you can go, you know, you'll go from there and determine together as a team what to do. All right, so our next step is, again, looking at any historical sampling data that we might have. Now, you may not have any sampling data, you may have limited sampling data, you might have old sampling data, but even limited or old data can still help you put together your sampling plan for the site inspection. It'll help you design it, it'll help you know where you might want to go back and collect some, either samples for the first time or additional samples. These are also, it also might help you know what you want to analyze for and what methods need to be used. Again, this also will help you when you're documenting your site score, because you want to make sure that if you do have historical data that you are going to use, that any data that you are collecting now in the present, that they're comparable, so that you're going to be able to compare them to the historical data and use that information to help you document your site score during the HRS process. So we talked earlier, I mentioned that there's a few plans that need to be completed before you go out and do your site inspection. The first one is the work plan. So this is really kind of like your administrative plan. It tells, you know, who's going to be doing the work, what's the schedule like, you know, about how long should it take to complete this, what kind of equipment are you going to be using, are you going to be using any labs, and if so, which ones. The work plan also just kind of gives a general summary of what you know about the site, like usual. Again, a description of the personnel that will be on site and what their role will be, if there's any kind of special training that anyone needs in order to get to be allowed to get onto the site or do the sampling, and then any kind of non-standard equipment that might be used or any kind of contracting services if you have to do a subcontract, you know, who are you doing that with, and what are they going to be doing. You should also have in here information that's specific to your site. So what are the hazards that you know of? And this is, again, based off of what you know already from your information in the PA and then just, you know, general knowledge of hazardous waste sites in general. So what kind of physical or chemical hazards might be encountered by the people doing the sampling? And then how will that affect the time frame? Is that going to delay work? Is it going to stop work? You know, what will it need additional equipment, and how will all that be procured? Is the site accessible? Is there a laboratory that's close to the site that you could drive your samples to instead of having to ship them? If not, how, you know, who are you going to use to ship your samples? Could the laboratory come deliver them or pick them up for you? Again, looking at the schedule, so again, you know, are we going to have, what kind of conditions are out there and how those might affect our time frame and any delays? And then, you know, when are we going to plan to mobilize, and then when are we going to demob, and how are we going to get the things there in time for us to start, and then how are they going to come off the site when we're finished and ready to demob? So again, your work plan includes just the background information that you know about the site. It also should have your objectives. So what are you planning to get out of this? What are your goals of doing the field activities that you have planned? And what do you need to accomplish those objectives and goals? Again, your schedule. And that should also include deliverables, not just the schedule of when you're going to do your field work and how long that will take, but also any deliverables afterwards. When are those going to be due, and, you know, how many copies, et cetera. And then again, who's going to be on the site, what they're going to be doing, any type of training that is required for them, and then the equipment that is going to be used. And then you'll also have an area where you talk about any non-standard equipment that you might use. So let's say you're going to have to maybe put in some maybe you're going to put in some wells, so you might need to hire someone to bring out a drill rig or, you know, a geoprobe. You know, that information would be included in that section. So that is the work plan. And then our next plan that we'll talk about is our health and safety plan. So really the purpose of the health and safety plan is not only to just protect the workers, your field sampling team that's going to be out at the site conducting the work, but also to protect the public, so anyone surrounding the site, as well as if it is an active facility, the workers that are on the site while you're conducting this work. Your health and safety plan, when it's completed, it must be distributed to everyone who's going to be at your site and doing work. You need to make sure that you have a, you know, what you usually call a tailgate meeting before you start any work out there, that just goes, and this is with everyone who's on the site, so it just goes through your health and safety plan and make sure that everybody has read the information, knows the information, knows what to do in the event of an emergency, has the contact information for everyone that they, you know, on site, and just make sure that everybody's read it and knows what to do or and has access to it in the event of an emergency. So again, it talks about the different levels of protection that you would wear for each one of the different field activities that you're going to be doing. What happens in an emergency, what are the procedures, what do we do, where's the nearest hospital, and then who are the key safety personnel, not only on site, but also, you know, back in your office. If you need to contact somebody, who do you need to contact, and what's their information? And then also, what are the monitoring requirements? So for health and safety purposes, what are you going to be monitoring? What equipment is going to be used? What are your action levels? That type of information. It also has each one of the different tasks that you're going to be doing and then the specific hazards or risks that are associated with that task. Again, I mentioned the key safety personnel, not only at your site, so who's your safety officer during the field work, but also back in the office, who do you need to contact, or who's the alternate to contact in case you can't get a hold of, you know, your primary safety person. And then again, what type of personal protection equipment should you be wearing based on either the location that you're working in. So if you're working in the hot zone or what you would call or exclusion zone, what type of PPE do you need to be in? Or it can also be designated by a task. So if you're doing, you know, soil sampling, you need to be in this level of PPE. And then that also describes what that PPE entails. So if you are required to be in level D PPE, your health and safety plan should also outline what all is included and must be worn if you are required to be in level D PPE, C, B, or A. And then the health and safety plan also outlines what your work areas are. So this is so that everybody knows the different zones, so the exclusion zone, your contamination reduction zone, and then your support zone, and also what levels of PPE are required in each one of those. They should be marked on a map, and then they should also, there should be control points for each one to make sure that people who are not properly dressed out or don't have the proper training can't, you know, just move from zone to zone freely. So more about the health and safety plan. Talks about security, you know, not letting anyone onto the site who's not trained properly to come onto the site. Any kind of monitoring that you might be doing around the site, if you're doing some invasive work, you know, maybe you'll be doing some dust monitoring around the perimeter to make sure that, you know, you're not, you know, that no contamination is migrating off to the, you know, whatever is surrounding the perimeter of the site. Again, any routine or special training that is required. So do your personnel need to have their OSHA HAZWOPR training and their 8-hour annual refreshers? Are you doing any other type of work that requires them to have special training, any confined space entry? That might be something that's done and requires special certification to do that. And then if there's any weather-related problems, what are the procedures that you're going to follow should you have that? Should there be a tornado, you know, either warning or watch in the area? What are the procedures for this? If it starts to storm, where's your meeting spot? Where do you, who do you contact? If the weather, you guys were mentioning that it was very hot in some areas right now, so that's another thing to consider. You know, are you monitoring for heat stress or cold stress? And what are the signs and symptoms, and what are you going to do if you think someone is experiencing one of those, you know, one of those conditions? And then emergencies. So you'll have information in there about emergencies, such as where is the nearest medical or emergency care facility. And with that, you'll want to make sure that that facility will take someone who has possibly been exposed to a chemical exposure. And then you'll also want to have the number of your nearest ambulance service so that you can get them on site if necessary. You'll want to be making sure that you're documenting everything so that when people ask you where was the person at when this emergency happened or what might they have been exposed to, you have that information available to let them know. And then any kind of decon procedures that need to be followed before the person can, you know, be taken to the hospital. Will the vehicle have to have a special decon, and what are those procedures? That information should be in your health and safety plan as well. continuing with the emergencies, you'll just want to make sure that you have that each person knows what their assignment will be should an emergency occur. And this is one thing, that, again, it'll be in the health and safety plan and should be gone over before you start any of your work. You'll also, you know, sometimes people laugh at this next bullet about identifying the location of the nearest telephone, but I think anybody who has done field work understands that, you know, your cell phone, as great as they can be sometimes, you know, you don't always get service everywhere. So you want to make sure that you, you know, as you're driving to your site, as you're doing some research, you've kind of identified where there might be a landline that you could go to in the event that, you know, cell coverage is not available or very unreliable, so that you can get a telephone to make communications with. You also want to designate alternatives. So again, if your cell phone is not working, you might bring out radios to the site, and each team has a radio to make sure you always have some kind of constant communication. Even air horns, you can designate sounds on the air horns, or like a number of beeps that signify that an emergency situation is happening, and you know that people need to start taking action. And then again, you'll want to make sure that you have all the contact information for local emergency responders, so fire department, police department, if the town has a hazmat unit, all that information should be available as well. If you need to evacuate the site, what are those procedures? And then any kind of on-site emergency equipment you might have. Do you have an eyewash? Do you have a shower? Do you have a backboard? Just a list of what you have available that could be used until medical support could get on site. Okay, so we put together two of our plans. We still have a couple more to talk about, but before we do that, we'll take a look at, in preparation for putting together our field sampling plan, we'll look at some of the different types of samples that we can collect while we're out there. So this list just gives a good idea of what are some of the different types of samples. So we have a bias sample, which is exactly what you would think it is. We've done some research, and we are selecting a location based on the information we have because we want to show that we have TCE at our site. And so because of that, we had a tank that we have information contain TCE, and so we're going to take a bias sample at that location because we know, well, we have information and we want to document that, so we want to prove that we have it there. So that's, we're just using knowledge of the site, maybe visual observations while you're out there, or that were observed during the preliminary assessment, that you specifically want to take a sample here because you want to show, you're hoping to show and confirm that you have hazardous substances there, or migration of hazardous substances there. Unbiased, you know, this is where maybe you don't have as much knowledge about your site, so you're kind of, you know, you're just using some best professional judgment on where you might collect some samples to hopefully, you know, document hazardous substances and their migration. Grab samples, this is where you're just collecting it from a specific location. A composite, this is where you are collecting small amounts from various locations and then putting it together as a representative sample. This is a good way, doing composite samples is a good way to identify hazardous substances that are present in maybe some of the sources that you have at the site. Media samples, these can just help you support a release that might have happened, and if you have contamination at a target. So you would use a media sample for that. Waste samples, these are a good way to see what kind of hazardous substances you have at the site, and then also to support attribution. So to make sure that we can say that this hazardous substance, we can attribute it back to our site. And then you have filtered and unfiltered samples. You know, most of the time you're going to be taking unfiltered samples, but there might be some instances where you're required to do filtered samples. One of those is if you're trying to show that you have an observed release of metals to a drinking water supply. All right, some other things to think about as you're preparing the sampling plan and thinking about sample collection are some of the things that can affect your sampling or your results. So obviously the way that the sample is collected can cause a lot of problems potentially with the outcome and with the sampling results. If it was sampled incorrectly, if the sample required preservation and it either was not preserved or it was preserved with the wrong preservative, that will cause problems. If there was any cross-contamination due to improper decontamination or no decontamination, these are all things that can affect the outcome of your sample. So you want to make sure that your sampling team is aware of your standard operating procedures for the different types of sampling that can be done and that they're following those procedures. They're taking the time to collect things properly, to decon in between samples, to make sure that everything is preserved properly. Also, there can be some variability spatially. So this is kind of how a substance and its concentration can vary from one location to another or based on distance and the various site conditions. So you'll want to keep that in mind that some substances, their concentration will be different based on the location of where you take the sample. Also, weather can play a big deal. Either weather or the season or even the time of the day possibly can cause some variability in your sampling results. High or low temperatures could possibly affect your results if you're sampling for volatile organic compounds. Obviously, rainfall or high winds or something like that could affect your results if you're collecting air samples. So you'll just want to keep that in mind. And then obviously each one of the different types of media that we collect can have things that you need to look out for. So, surface water and groundwater, you could have different flow rates. Some compounds are heavier than water, some are lighter than water. So you want to make sure that you're sampling at the correct depth for the hazardous substances that you're looking for. For soil and sediment, you want to make sure that you're documenting the location, the depth at which you collected the sample, and what the soil or sediment looked like, a description of it at that depth. Again, with air, I mentioned you want to be documenting the wind speed and the direction of the wind, what's the temperature during sample collection. And then if you collect any tissue samples, this can also be based on the type of organism. So you want to make sure that you're collecting like organisms and organisms that are comparable and can be compared, similar ages of the organism. Are they migratory? Again, just to make sure that all of this is comparable and it's defensible in your HRS package. And then if you're going to do any type of containerized sampling, so drums, tanks, anything like that, again, as many people know, a drum is probably very rarely, especially at, an abandoned site or somewhere where maybe their waste handling procedures are not the best, you get things mixed together, you get solids put in with liquids. So, the chances of a drum or a tank being homogeneous the entire way through the container are probably slim. So you want to make sure that you are getting a representative sample of that tank and drum, and hopefully being able to get a sample from each of the different layers throughout it, if it does have different layers and different consistencies in it. All right, so again, so looking at the sampling and why we're doing it, we're trying to see if we have any targets that are exposed to hazardous substances from our site. This is also important for the HRS process, obviously, but it's also a safety matter, too, because if the public or environment are being exposed to hazardous substances, you know, obviously that needs to be known and steps need to be taken. So this is also a way to just document that that's happening, and so that measures can be taken to help prevent that, to get the process started to help prevent that. The samples can also help us demonstrate a release if that has occurred. And they can also, again, help us identify what hazardous substances that we have at the site and document that they are attributable to that site because of operating procedures or other documentation that we have. And then again, as I said, to demonstrate a release, we need to have analytical data that shows we have a hazardous substance at levels that are significantly above our background, and then that also show that it is attributable to the site. We also want to make sure that we're sampling to make sure that there isn't an alternative source of contamination. So, you know, this is to help you document that if there's another site nearby that has some possible contamination, that you're collecting samples that to help you still show that at least part of your site is attributing to the contamination. So you're collecting samples to confirm that it is coming from your site and that it's not attributable to another site. Also, again, we want to make sure that we have appropriate background, collect appropriate background samples so that we know what our background concentrations are, so that we know if samples collected out, you know, to show potential contamination to targets as well as from our sources, that we know what our background is so that we know if our targets are being contaminated, that we're above those background concentrations. And then also just to make sure that all the proper procedures were followed so that samples were collected in the appropriate manner, they followed standard operating procedures, and not only the field team, but also the laboratory, that the laboratory followed their standard operating procedures as well. Just to make sure that, again, we have defensible data and we have defensible information that we can move forward with in the HRS. So now that you've thought about some of those things, the different types of samples, the different things that can lead to some issues with your sample results, you'll put together the field sampling plan. And your field sampling plan is the tool that your sampling team is going to be using while they're out at the site to properly collect all the samples that need to be collected to help you put together your SI report and move forward with the site. So your field sampling plan, it should have in your proposed sampling locations, the type of samples that you're going to collect, and then the number of samples that you're planning to collect. So again, your field sampling plan should have a section on field operations. So this is what are the field activities that are going to be done, who's going to be doing them, So who's going to actually collect the samples? Who's going to be your safety officer? Who's going to maintain the logbook during the process? Who's going to supervise chain of custody to make sure that your samples are not leaving your site in order, you know, for somebody or to maybe mess with them or something like that? But you want to make sure that you have somebody who's kind of controlling that chain of custody to ensure that, you know, you have those samples in your possession and you know nothing is happening to them. There should also be a section on, again, the locations and then why you're taking them there. So each sampling location preferably should be put on a map, and then why you're collecting it there, the type of sample that's being collected at that location, and then how much sample you need. You know, different samples, different analyses, different media require a different amount of volume to be collected, and then the number of samples at that location. You also want to make sure that you're collecting your quality control samples. So these are like your trip blanks, your field blanks, your duplicates, your MS, MSDs, matrix spike duplicate. I apologize for the acronym. You're going to have in there how many of those you should collect, and then where you're planning on collecting them. Also, in a section on decontamination, so your sampling equipment that you are going to use. What are your decon procedures? What types of solution are you going to be using to decon them? Is it the proper solution, you know, to make sure that you're using the proper solution for that particular contaminant? And then if there's any kind of special handling that needs to occur. And then you're going to look at what the analytical requirements are and then the sample handling. So in this section, this is where you would talk about the specific, what you're specifically going to analyze the various samples for. So what method, is a preservative required? And if so, what is that preservative? Do you need to filter the samples or not? What equipment will be used for each of the specific samples that you're going to be collect? What type of containers need to be used? You know, some media needs to be in an amber glass jar. Others can just be in a glass jar. Some need to be in plastic containers. So all of that needs to be laid out in your field sampling plan so that your team knows what they have all the information to collect those samples properly. And then there should be a section on how are you going to get your samples to the laboratory. So no matter what laboratory you're using, are you going to deliver them by hand? Can you drive them to the laboratory because it's a local lab? Can a courier from the laboratory come pick them up for you? Or are you going to have to ship them? And if you have to ship them, then, you know, considering shipping procedures and, you know, do you have dangerous goods that you're, you know, you need to do a dangerous goods shipment? How quickly do you need to get them there? Some samples have very short holding times. They need to be processed and analyzed within, you know, a 24-hour period. So that information needs to be in here that can be taken into account to make sure that you're getting your samples to the laboratory in the correct amount of time. So talking about laboratories, there's really two types that can be used. Most of you have probably heard about the contract laboratory program, or CLIP, as most people call it. So these are laboratories that the EPA has audited and reviewed and has been approved by the EPA that they are able to provide very good data quality for their samples. So they've been approved by EPA. They're an EPA CLIP lab. They give you the data that you need. to document that, you know, you have defensible data here, it's been collected properly, the lab is going to analyze it properly. They can do, you know, they can do most things. They do metals, they can do target compound lists, organics. If you use a CLIP lab, you have a good feeling that, you know, that they're going to follow the procedures because they've already been audited to make sure that they do that. So they're going to follow their operating procedures. They're going to meet hold times. They're going to provide a data validation on the sample results and provide that to you. So you know that you're working with quality labs. You can also use non-contract laboratory program labs. So these are your private labs that just aren't a part of the CLIP program. If you do use a non-CLIP laboratory, you'll just want to make sure that they can provide the same quality data of a CLIP laboratory. So you'll want to make sure that when you're bidding that work out or when you're talking to the non-CLIP lab, that they can, you know, have the same methods, they have the same turnaround times, they use the same protocols, they'll provide you with the same level quality control data so that you can perform a data validation on the sample results that they provide to you. So you just want to make sure that if you do use a non-CLIP lab, they can still provide you that same level of data quality that a CLIP laboratory can. So there also are different field-based technologies that can be used in the field, some different screening tools, and XRF is a good example of this, X-ray fluorescence detectors. Some people might even have gas chromatographs that they can have out at the site with them. So these are different things that can also be used in a screening thing to kind of maybe help you narrow down while you're out there where you should collect samples or maybe help you get, you know, an extent of contamination or follow a possible migration pathway from a source. It can help you, you know, design sampling grids, maybe where you should install a temporary or a permanent monitoring well. Where you should maybe screen your wells. The only thing to think about, you know, when you're using field screening tools is you should follow that up with CLIP quality data. So you should collect some samples that are sent to the laboratory to just confirm what you are seeing on your screening tool. You also have to remember that sometimes you might be looking for something that there's no screening tool for. You know, maybe it just doesn't, some chemicals, you know, just may not have a screening tool out there that can be used to detect them. So that's a situation where you wouldn't have a tool to use. You'd have to collect samples and send them to a lab. If you are going to use screening tools, you'll want to make sure that, again, this is included in your field sampling plan and that EPA, your regional management, has reviewed that and approved your use of that screening tool and what you're proposing to use that screening tool for. And then also in your QAQC plan, which we will talk about next, that you have in there what the standard operating procedures are for that particular piece of equipment so that everybody knows how to properly use it and then how to read the results from it. Again, just to make sure that it's being used appropriately. So I mentioned we would talk about the Quality Assurance Project Plan. So this is really the plan that helps the sampling team and the project team make sure that the methods you're following and the data you're collecting and the results that you get from that effort are of the best quality and defensible to help you support the decision that are being made regarding the site to move forward. So it's just a way to ensure that everything you're doing is going to be defensible to get you that site score and to document that site score. We've talked about that your HRS packages, they need to have defensible data, they need to have the highest quality level data. So your quality assurance project plan helps you make sure that everybody is collecting that to the best of their abilities, and that the data that you're going to receive from this sampling effort are going to be usable and are going to be of high quality and not questioned. So again, I pretty much, went over the purpose of it. It looks at, the analytical methods that are being used, just saying, can this be used? This is pretty much when you're doing the part of the quality assurance project plan, or part of that process is your data validation. So this is when you're looking at the data and, pretty much you're just answering the question, can this data be used? Is it, did the lab follow all their procedures properly? Did they use the right method? All of that. So can it be your data validation? The purpose of that is to say that your data that was the output of your sampling, it can be used. It is good. You can move forward with it. Things that a data validator would look at, again, were sampling protocols and procedures used? Did they use the correct methods to do that? They want to look at the dates and the locations of the samples. How were the samples collected and how were they prepared? Those techniques to make sure that it doesn't look like there was any possible cross-contamination or the incorrect preservatives used. And then they're also looking at what the laboratory did. So they're looking at how the laboratory prepared the samples for analysis. Again, did they use the right methods? They look at the results to see if they look like they're accurate. They look at the method detection limits. They look at the QA/QC samples that were collected and analyze and compare those back with the sample results and make sure that those look like everything is accurate and usable. And then, really all of your data that you're collecting needs to be validated. It needs to be looked at to make sure that holding times were met. It needs to make sure that calibration of laboratory instruments was done properly to make sure that the correct detection limits were used for each one of the instruments. And then for data validation, if you are using a CLIP laboratory, most of the CLIP laboratories provide a data validation report to you. They usually put a little summary in the front that shows it's been validated and just kind of gives a synopsis of everything. That's most of the time. On a non-CLIP lab, so if you're using a private lab that's not part of the CLIP program, that data will need to be validated. The laboratory does not do the validation. That obviously would be a conflict of interest if they did. So you would need to make sure that you had on your project team a chemist or someone else very familiar with analytical procedures, that when you receive that data package from your non-CLIP laboratory, can go through and look at all the different information in it and all the calibration logs and all that information and do a proper data validation to show if the data can be used, if it needs to have any qualifiers and what that qualifier is, if any of the data had to be rejected, which you hope never happens, but sometimes that does happen. Holding times get missed. Things can happen, but that should be something that that's looked at? Is, you know, is the data usable? Is it just estimated, or is it a rejection? And then an explanation of that. There should also be the data validator should be able to tell you, is the can the data be used for, are there any limitations on it, or can it be used for whatever purpose it was collected for? They're also looking at different things. Again, the correct sampling protocols were used. Looking for typographical errors as well. I mean, everybody makes mistakes, and sometimes, you know, even lab reports can have errors in them. So they're checking that information as well to make sure everything was reported properly. Looking to see if maybe, you know, they're looking at those quality control samples that you collected, the trip blanks and the field blanks and the duplicates, to see if maybe there was some cross-contamination that might have happened either during shipment or even during the actual analysis process. So that's all the information that they're using, your chemist is using, to put together that data validation report that'll be really important to show, is this data good, and can we move, you know, can we move forward with it, and is it defensible? So I mentioned earlier, too, that when you're out there collecting these samples, you'll probably develop some investigation-derived waste, IDW, and so that's another thing that you will have to plan for, is the IDW that is created during your sampling. So EPA developed this directive. It's the management of investigation-derived waste during site inspections. It pretty much just kind of goes over how some options to manage IDW that's generated. Typically, EPA does not recommend removing waste, especially if it's not going to pose any kind of immediate threat to either the environment or human health. Or if, you know, removal of it would be very expensive. So typically, if the IDW can remain on site, that's their preference. Different types of IDW, so this could be if you're doing some geoprobe sampling, the soil cuttings from that. If you are collecting groundwater samples and you're purging your wells first, that purge water. If you're using disposable sampling equipment or your PPE, those are also considered types of IDW. So really, the directive that EPA put together, its purpose is really just to try to find some cost-efficient and safe ways to handle the waste that are derived from the sampling process. But also try to help you minimize the amount of waste that is generated during this process as well. And then also to just some suggestions on, you know, how to leave a site the way that it was, you know, not leave it in a worse condition than when you conducted your inspection. And then just to make sure that everything is being conducted in accordance, you know, with applicable policies, guidance, and laws. The directive does have some specific elements to it on how to characterize IDW. You could use, if there's manifests on that you have available, safety data sheets could be another one. If you just know the process how the waste was generated, if you have test results, maybe some, you could do maybe a little bit of hazard categorization at the site to try to determine what you have. So it gives some information on that. And then there's also, you know, to keep in mind what the National Contingency Plan requires in response to investigation-derived waste. So, you know, the NCP says that you need to make sure that you are managing that waste that's in compliance with all of the ARARs to the extent practicable. And then what the considerations are for handling that IDW. And there's also a directive for that that we provide in the manual if you choose to download that. All right, so we have put all of our plans together. We went out and we did our sampling, or we did our field activity. And so now we're getting ready to put together our site inspection report and document everything that we did. So again, we're looking at is the data that we collected, is this good enough for what we intended it for? Did we collect this information and these samples to screen the site to see if we should, if it has the hazardous substances and everything to move forward and should be placed on the MPL or not, or to another program? Or were we collecting this data to list the site? So we want to make sure that we're meeting our, that the data quality is meeting the intended use for what we collected it for. You know, some people use analytical results for different things. If you're just screening the site, you might, you know, look at it differently than if you are trying to list your site. So, you know, that would be something to keep in mind as well, looking at the QA QC information to make sure, again, that it was, that the data was obtained in the best manner, in the most defensible manner. And then, you know, other things to look at with your data quality, we want to make sure that our background samples, if they had higher concentrations, that may not be analytical data that we would want to use then, because or we need to take that into consideration and kind of go back and see what that means. You know, this is where we're also looking to make sure that we don't think we had any improper sampling procedures that might have occurred, or even laboratory contamination. So again, that's where that data validation report comes in, because that should be documented in there as well. Again, we're reviewing it for excessive holding times to make sure that that did not happen. So again, we're just looking at our data quality one more time to make sure that it is usable and defensible and we can move forward with it, and we don't need to maybe go back and collect some additional information. So our SI report, you'll notice as we talk about it, kind of has a similar layout as the PA report that we did. Again, the purpose of it is just to let people know what did we do. So again, background about the site, what activities did we do there, were conducted at the site, the information that we researched, the samples that we collected, where we collected them from, just, you know, why did we do this SI. There is a suggested format for the SI. We'll go through that and what each section should have. But you'll also want to make sure that you look at your regional guidelines as well, because each region might have some specific information that they want included that maybe, you know, the standard format doesn't have or another region doesn't have. Also remember, just like the PA report, this is a public information resource, so the public will be able to read this, and it should contain the information necessary to make sure that you can to support EPA's decision on the site to move forward. So we have an introduction. This introduction, again, just why did we do the site inspection? Who performed it, what authority it was performed under, what's the name of the site, and then what were the objectives of our site inspection? Again, our objectives and our goals, why did we do it? The next section is the site description and regulatory history. So again, what type of site is it, how long was it in operation, Were there any previous investigations done at the site? And the next section is your operations history and waste characteristics. So this again, what were the operations at the site? Who are current owners, past owners? Do you know what kind of waste were generated? What were their disposal practices? What sources did they have on the site? Describing the type of containment for each one of those sources, and then quantities. If you have any sampling results from previous investigations, you can talk about those in this section. And then if you know of any hazardous substances that are associated with the sources, you would discuss that in that section as well. And then, just like the PA report, we talk about each one of the four pathways. And we just talk about, you know, for the groundwater, the setting, the use that's within our 4-mile TDL. Do we have any wellhead protection areas? If you have previous sampling results from groundwater efforts, then you would want to include that in there. Same thing for surface water. If you have any previous sampling results that were collected from surface water bodies, that would be put into this section. You're also looking at that 15-mile TDL and what, you know, do you have fisheries within that TDL? Are there sensitive environments there? And then, again, you're going to discuss in each one of these your results from your SI sampling and what those results are. That's for all the pathways, groundwater, surface water, soil, and air, if you collected samples for all of those. Again, then we talk about the soil exposure pathway, the air pathway, and then you'll have a summary that, again, just does what a summary normally does. What are the major aspects about the site? And then you'll go through and just give a summary on each one of your pathways and what the targets of concern are for each one of the pathways. And then you'll also summarize your sampling results. And then you'll have your photo documentation log. And then your different appendices. That should include your data validation report, your analytical results, and then your data validation report as well. And then we have the references. And so that's just like in the PA as well. If you were using a site-specific reference, you need to have a complete copy of that attached. If it's just kind of a general reference, you can just include the title page and then what the pertinent pages are, and just those can be attached rather than the entire document. So in this one, you know, we mentioned that, you know, really for the SI, we're trying to see if it needs to be screened out at this time or if it should be, if we should move forward with the HRS scoring and it should be placed on the NPL. We talked about what the basic tasks were. So again, reviewing that available information, developing those plans, conducting the actual field work, and then evaluating all that data and putting together the site inspection report. During the planning and preparation portion of the SI activities, this is where you're looking at that PA report to make sure that you're not duplicating efforts, to see what the hypotheses are that you need to test during the SI. We're getting site access to make sure that we can be at the site and working on it. We're looking at that historical data that we have to see if it can be used to, you know, either to compare to data that we collect now or to help us maybe just come up with a sampling plan. We're preparing those different plans that we need, so the work plan, the field sampling plan, our health and safety plan, and the quality assurance project plan. And then we're establishing proper QA/QC so that our team is following proper procedures, the laboratory is following proper procedures, so that we get the best data possible that is defensible and can be used in the HRS scoring package. Again, the plans, they are they're prepared prior to doing any type of field work. And then we talked a little bit about the IDW and, you know, using that directive to try to minimize the amount of IDW that is created when you're doing a site inspection. And then if you do have some, you know, kind of cost-efficient ways to properly manage that. And then we put together our SI report. So again, very similar to the BA report. We just have new information now. So we have a section on what we know about the site, its backgrounds. We talk about each one of our four pathways and our sampling results from the SI for each one of the pathways that we evaluated. Again, we talk about our targets and if we have, you know, new targets or if we confirmed targets from our PA hypotheses. And then we give a summary of the analytical results collected during the site inspection. We talked about doing data validation on the sampling, the samples that we have collected. So when you get that, you know, if you're using a CLIP laboratory, they most will typically do that validation for you. But I would also suggest that you have your chemist just review that summary to make sure everything does look legitimate. And then if you're using a non-CLIP laboratory, you have a chemist available to review that data package when it comes back from the laboratory to, again, just make sure that all the proper procedures were used and the data is usable. And then just remember that this report, just like the PA report, it will be used to move forward, and it is used to document EPA's decision on moving forward with the site, or, you know, whatever happens with the site, if they defer it to another program or if they decide it needs to be no further action. You know, this report helps document that that decision. So at this point, we will open it up to questions on this portion.
I think you're getting ready to take some questions now, Jody?
Yeah, please.
Okay, so we have a number of questions that have come in through the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. Participants can continue to submit them. We'll get through as many as we can in the current break. This first question came in early on, and one of our participants would like to know, do you do the focused SI first and then, based on those results, perform the expanded SI?
Yes, and you know, a lot of times too in today's just kind of environmental world that we live in with limited budgets and stuff, you may not even do a focused and an expanded SI. You might just go out and do one site inspection that gives you all of the information that you need. However, if you are looking at a phased approach, then you would do the focused first and collect the information you need to ensure that the site should go forward, and then you do the expanded site inspection where then you would be collecting the data, you know, for to be used in the HRS scoring package.
Okay. Our next question, do you need an EPA HASP or can a contractor develop this for you?
Well, you should, if your company is doing the work, you will develop a health and safety plan that meets the requirements for your company. However, EPA, if you're working for EPA, they will need to review it. You should submit it to them, and they'll review it to ensure that they agree with, you know, the procedures and everything that you're laying out there. But you can, you know, I mean, if your company has one, you can use that and then submit it to EPA for their approval.
Okay. And in reference to slide 7-17, when would you use filtered versus non-filtered samples?
Well, really the only time that you would do a filtered sample is if you are collecting a water sample for metals analysis. And a lot of times now, too, you know, with using low-flow technologies, we very rarely filter samples anymore. But it would typically just be in that instance, if you're looking for metals and it's specifically calling for you to filter it. Otherwise, you're very rarely going to do that.
Okay. And then, again, slide 7-25, you commented that under the CLP, is data validated from the lab? Is that true? Or is it an internal review completed by lab personnel? There's a difference between those two.
So if you're using a CLIP lab, the way that if data validation is performed the way that it typically happens, and I can speak for Region 5 since that's where I am, the laboratory provides the data to an EPA person in the CLIP program. They review it and they provide the summary report. So it's not, and I should have clarified, I apologize, if ABC Laboratory is a CLIP lab and performing the analysis, they are not doing the data validation as well. It would be, they would provide that information, their package, to the people who work in the EPA CLIP program, and they would review it, and then the EPA CLIP program person would provide that summary. So it's not the lab who's actually doing the validation. I should have clarified. I apologize.
Okay. Our next participant asks, does the data from a sample with multiple qualifiers on surrogate recovery, does the data from a sample with multiple qualifiers on surrogate recovery for several parameters meet validation criteria?
Well, I honestly do not have a good answer for that. I do not validate data, so I think that would just be something that you'd have to work with your chemist with to see if that, to see if that would be able to be used, especially if it has multiple qualifiers that, multiple qualifiers is probably going to get some questions later on down the road, so it might be a good instance where maybe, unfortunately, you might have to go back out and collect those, that sample or the samples in question again, because normally you want to have data that's not qualified.
Okay. And our next question, regarding the analytical laboratory of choice, does a contract laboratory protocol certification result in better quality of data than a laboratory with a NELAP, NELAP certification?
Not necessarily. The main thing is that especially if you're doing this for an EPA project, using a CLIP laboratory, you know that they have gone through a strenuous inspection or audit to ensure that they follow procedures, follow methods, and provide a high quality of data. Like I mentioned, you can get that same level of quality with a non-CLIP lab or one, that's NELAP certified. The main thing that you want to do is that you just want to make sure that if you do select a non-CLIP laboratory, you want to make sure that they can provide that same level of data that a CLIP lab would be able to do.
Okay. And then we've had people ask where they can find a list for a CLP or CLIP lab in their particular region.
So you should have, I don't know if there's a list. That's a good question, and I'll work on that while Therese is talking. Mm-hmm. But typically how it is each region has a regional coordinator and an EPA CLIP regional coordinator who's actually at EPA, and you would submit your request to them, and then based on what you need, what your analysis is, what you're analyzing for, they would recommend – they would say what lab you're going to go to that's in the CLIP program. I'm not sure if there's one that's just out there, but I will look that up and see what I can find.
Okay. All right, and then our last question right now for our break, should data be collected with a potential, with the mindset of a potential remedial design? So when you're out there doing your investigation, should you also be collecting additional data that might be collected with that potential remedial design in mind?
Well, I think the only, I mean, it's always good to limit the amount of times that you have to go to a site and limit the amount of samples to be collected, because it is costly each time you mobilize, and samples are not cheap as well. But something to keep in mind for this is if you are doing the site inspection, you don't have a lot of money to conduct one of these typically. So if possible, yes, it would be great to try to collect data that can serve more than one purpose, to that can serve the purpose of documenting, testing your PA hypotheses, showing that this site needs to go on into the HRS process and be put on the MPL, and then hopefully be able to use that data when you get in, to an RIFS or, a remedial design. I think you should try for that, but you should also remember that the purpose of this is it's a limited amount of samples, again, a limited amount of time and effort, and the point of this is really to see if it should move forward and then, what you need to get it on the MPL.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we're going to continue on with the webinar now. We will take another break for questions later on in today's session. But, Therese, whenever you're ready to begin, feel free to carry on. And remember, we've got about 28 minutes or so left in today's time slot.
All right. Well, this is a pretty quick little module because all of these things are going to be discussed in detail as we discuss each pathway, and that's in modules 8 and 9. So I'll move through it fairly quickly. This is just to remind you that there are a large number of factors that you have to think about when you're putting your sampling strategy together, and you have two purposes when you're out there as an investigator. One is to try to feed the HRS scoring process and to be selective about the data that you chase, making sure that it really informs your HRS score or your HRS decision making in a meaningful way. It's a lot of fun collecting data and trying to prove up something, but we really need to focus in on those bits of data that bump up your HRS score. And don't chase data that really doesn't get you anything. And then on the other side here of the slide, we have removal action. And that's because as an investigator, when you're out there looking at site conditions, you'll have boots on the ground, you'll be there looking at your site. You need to understand if you see conditions that you think would arise to an immediate threat and could likely trigger a removal action, you would refer those to the removal program, to USEPA's regional removal program. And for some of those things, that's why we have unstable containers and fire and explosion here. Those are all conditions that you would refer. So you're not just doing HRS, you are an investigator looking at site conditions and referring them to the proper direction. So after this little module, you should understand that you need to identify all your potential sources, those defined by HRS. You need to understand the degree to which you should delineate the boundaries and calculate the quantity for those particular sources. And again, that's the idea of what information do you really need to collect. And then evaluating containment for all your sources. And then finally, attributing the contamination that you may associate with those sources back to site activities and operations that occurred in the past. And we have a little case study example that we run through today, and I think we continue in our pathway discussions. So here's some of the things to consider about when you're demonstrating a release. So first I'm going to talk about sources and then demonstrating a release. You really need to understand that what it means to have an observed release by chemical analysis, and I'll discuss what that is. And after taking this, you should be able to explain that to someone else. how you quantify actual contamination, and that is very pathway specific. The importance of establishing background levels, attributing contamination or an increase, a significant increase, at least in part to your sources and site, and then distinguishing between levels of contamination at targets, and that's mainly level one and level two contamination. So you'll have a good understanding of all of that, you know, once we make it through this module and then the next two modules. So let's talk about sources. There are, I think, 11 source types. We've talked about them in detail in the PA portion. But let's think about what you might do to actually sample some of these sources. In order to characterize the sources, it generally requires the collecting of some source samples. And this is especially important to identify the specific hazardous substances associated with those sources and then tie that information back to the site activities and operations that occurred. So you sort of you tie it up in a nice package. And then you'll want to make sure that you attribute hazardous substances to the sources. Sample as many different types of sources as you have at the site. And then you may also need this to identify the contaminants so that you can pick out the nastiest ones that give you the highest score. So you're looking at identifying any contaminants that, and they're pathway specific. So TCE presents a big problem in groundwater because it's highly mobile, but it doesn't get you so much in the surface water pathway. Whereas PAHs or PCBs don't get you so much in the groundwater pathway, but they really can give you a lot of points in the surface water pathway. So it's good to identify sort of the different types of hazardous substances that you have from your sources in order to be able to use the very highest numbers that you can get from SCIDM when you're putting toxicity with mobility and persistence. And then, of course, you need to pay attention to potential transformation products. So these are the sort of the breakdown products of the contaminants originally used at the site. Understanding that they may be at your sources or in the media that you might sample, and that they can be attributed back to your site even though they are only breakdown products. So, Jean, I'm going to do the poll. Okay, all right. So here we have a couple polls. This is sort of a two-part question, and this is really testing your memory. So which of the, I would like you to pick the correct answer from this first one. Which of the following has the correct order based on which tier is the hardest to document for site sources?
And to vote, simply click the circle to the left of the answer that best matches your reply. If you have problems with the poll in the lower left, you can also type up an answer in the Q&A window on the far right.
All right, we got about 70 people here. But we don't have much time. So most of you are getting it right. It is the bottom bullet. So it's tier A, B, C, and D. So it's most difficult to quantify tier A, and then less difficult for tier B, less difficult for tier C, and the easiest for tier D. And most sites use tier C or D. All right, let's go to the next one. Which level of data is the most acceptable or more stringent for the HRS for HRS to document hazardous substances in a source? All right, we can close this one too, Jean. You are correct. Most of you are correct. It is when you have chemical analysis of that source. That is the most stringent and the best way to document. But it's not the only way to document, especially if you have a lot of good information from the facility itself. All right, so as you're conducting your site inspection and planning and strategizing about what you're going to do, you need to think about how much work you're going to do to define your source boundaries. Sometimes sampling is necessary to define particular source boundaries, especially the contaminated soil type. So in order to identify a patch of contaminated soil, you usually do need to sample that contaminated soil. You'll also need some sampling to establish how to draw your target distance limits, so identifying all those sources and then putting together your TDL from those. However, you can get a lot of physical measurements just from aerial photographs or potentially facility records, and then you can also just make those measurements when you're there on the site yourself in order to define your boundaries of your sources. As you're out there and you're looking at the site, one of the best ways to document containment is through field observations. So as you're taking your notes in your logbook and examining and measuring the site's sources, you'll also want to evaluate their containment. And depending on the pathways that you're pursuing, you know, usually it'll be one or two pathways, I would go ahead and bring those tables from HRS with you as a checklist to be able to, you know, say the right words in your documentation that line right up with the words in the checklist and give you an obvious point value. You also can sample to support aggregation of sources. So if you have multiple sources at the site and they all have the same sort of material in them, there is a way to add them all together, and you would probably need to document that they are similar enough through sampling. And then finally, the sampling can be conducted in order to calculate your hazardous quantity. But in this case, you really need to take a look at the ranges that you are working with in order to get more or usually more points or what would give you less points. So when you're thinking about that, take a hard look at Table 2-6 from HRS, which gives you sort of the ranges of values. And, you know, for one of those ranges, it's from 10,000 to 1 million. So you usually only would collect a lot of information if you're near a breakpoint where you could, you know, adding a little volume or a little more quantity would get you something. But if you're smack dab in the middle of a, you know, million point range, there's really, that is chasing data that really does nothing for you. So think about that and realize that there are some types, source types, that give you pretty good numbers with either C or D tiers, and then some source types that are such as surface impoundments, waste piles, landfills, they give you decent scores in C and D, but contaminated soil is a really difficult thing to score very high on. So think about all those things as you're strategizing for your source sampling. So you'll be looking at all the source types and calculating sort of the minimum number of samples that you would need to characterize those sources. Really think about the safety of the samplers. The SI guidance recommends that you really think twice before sampling drums or tanks or other types of containers. That is sort of a specialized sampling procedure, and they suggest, the SI guidance suggests instead, to try sampling the soil directly around or underneath the drums or containers, and especially if there are signs that they've been leaking, so that you don't actually have to sample the drum or container itself. And then use everything at your disposal when you're strategizing. All that non-sampling data that you have from the facility records or any historical or existing analytical data that might have been generated maybe through inspections by local authorities or by the state over time. We have a few checklists in your manual that you should check out. That there's a table 3-8 and an exhibit 3-1, and they talk about how to evaluate existing data to determine the extent to which you feel comfortable using it. And then we also have a checklist to talk about how to decide the appropriate level of QA/QC based on what you're going to use the data for. So if you're going to take an XRF out there to determine where to collect a soil sample that will show you maybe where the highest level of arsenic is, you would not have the same level of QA/QC for those XRF samples as you would for the samples that you send off to the analytical laboratory for the CLP type analyses. So in general, this is what source sampling strategies look like. This is a table taken right out of the SI guidance. So the primary objective is to identify hazardous substances associated with the sources and to confirm known or suspected sources and to help you quantify your hazardous waste quantity. The data quality is usually quite high. Data use category 1 is the highest of all, but it could also be 2, a little less quality. And you're going to want a sample to also demonstrate any observed contamination. So samples used to test your hypothesis of soil contamination within the top 2 feet of the surface. So when you're defining your AOCs, your areas of observed contamination, and you're now outside your actual source areas and you're looking at contaminated soil into maybe a residential neighborhood, that takes a good deal of thinking in order to put together a good sampling strategy. You'll want to also look and see if you need to sample to look at containment. A lot of times you don't need to sample in order to evaluate containment. If you do, then you would collect those samples. I don't think it's done very often. And then finally, you may need samples to describe the boundaries and estimate your hazardous waste quantity, but make sure that knowing the depth of that surface impoundment is really going to buy you something. So you might postulate that, boy, what if it's 4 feet deep? How does that change my volume calculation using tier C as opposed to tier D? So I would run those numbers ahead of time and see really does this additional information buy you anything in terms of its HRS score. So we have a little case study we're going to talk about here. It's an abandoned strawberry farm, but lo and behold, they did not just have strawberries on this farm. They also did some plating work. So the thing that led it to being having a site inspection is the electroplating that was done. And so the features we have are a surface impoundment that has electroplating sludge, a drum storage area with 30 leaking drums, and some stained soil. And we can see what that looks like. So here we have our surface impoundment, this big purple feature. This is a blob of stained soil, and here we have these drums. And you know, this is not to scale, because these drums would be really big compared to those houses. So remember that it's not necessarily to scale. I think we have a little question here for you to answer. So in order to properly document the hazardous substances in the surface impoundment, a minimum of 3 source samples are needed. Okay, we're running about 50-50 with not very many people responding.
Remember, you'll see that poll in the lower left half of your screen just below the slides. Again, if you're having any problems interacting with the poll, you can use the Q&A window in the lower right to type up your answer, whether it's true or false.
All right, so the falses are now a little bit ahead of the trues. The false is the correct answer. Source sampling does not require 3 samples. If you're sampling a source, you can just have 1 sample that shows the presence of a hazardous substance, and that would be enough. So the 3 samples is more of a soil surface soil sampling issue. All right, so remembering what you saw there with our Lakefield Farm site, let's talk about how they strategized for their SI sampling. They decided for the source sampling they were going to collect one source sample from impoundment sediments plus one sludge sample to evaluate the presence of hazardous substances. So this is a very biased and judgmental sampling approach, going for the very worst they can with their sampling effort. So they really, the consideration here is that it would take 675,000 cubic feet to increase the hazardous waste quantity factor value to its next category. And that's a lot. So there's really no use in trying to make it seem like the surface impoundment has a larger quantity than it does. And then some non-sampling considerations is they want to obtain the physical dimensions of the source, evaluate its containment, and consider the use of aerial photographs, historical aerial photographs, to see how big that impoundment really was. For the drum storage area, they're not going to sample the drums. They're going to sample the soil beneath the drums. They see that they are leaking. They feel that that's a safer way to proceed. And the drums are easy to count, but you can see it would take 1,000 more drums to actually raise the score, the HWQ, to the next factor value. So the non-sampling is easy. Verify the number of the drums, evaluate their containment and document it. Look for container markings on the drums to see if you can determine if they have any labels, and then examine the area around the drums to determine the extent potentially of soil contamination associated with it. And then for the stained soil, they're going to just collect one superficial sample to determine if the area is contaminated and to identify the hazardous substances that might be there. Again, 78 acres of contaminated soil would be needed to bump it up to the next category. Contaminated soil has a huge divisor. It's just not a great way to get a high HWQ. But they would obtain those physical dimensions and then evaluate containment. Now we're going to talk a little bit about demonstrating a release. We aren't really going to discuss our particular facility here. We'll do that in the actual pathway discussion. But as you can see, the features we see here now, I would say the groundwater pathway is probably looking like a potential, as well as the surface soil pathway. I don't yet see any surface water features. So when you're considering demonstrating a release, you have to be able to show that your site is contributing, or the increase in contamination can be attributed to your site. And so you need to consider background. And that is very pathway specific. So here we have what you think about in groundwater. We know groundwater flow is heading this way. We don't know that from these two wells. You know, you need three wells in order to determine groundwater flow direction, so they must have had that some other way. But then we have a background well, up gradient of the site, and a down gradient well. The background well would hopefully be clean, and if the landfill were releasing, we should be able to see it here and establish that we have demonstrated a release by chemical analysis. So depending on the pathway you're in, it's either down gradient, it could be down slope for the surface soil pathway, it could be downwind for the air pathway, and downstream for the surface water pathway. Here are the three big considerations for determining that you have had a release. Establishing that you have essentially not clean background, but that your source is attributing to contamination, and you can tell that by examining the background samples, and that you have targets that are either actually or potentially exposed. So all these things are what you consider when you're documenting your release. So for background sampling, you need to establish the release by chemical analysis. If that's how you're establishing it, it requires that you evaluate background. And background is really just defined as the ambient concentration that you would expect for that particular chemical in the media that you're talking about, considering where that media is coming from. So if you're in a relatively uncontaminated area, not heavily industrialized, then it may be easier to prove up background. If you're in a heavily industrialized area and you are significantly above background, you need to show that the significant increase is in part due to the particular site you're looking at. We're going to repeat this about a bajillion times, but background and release samples need to be similar. So similar soil types, similar depth of groundwater, similar species, similar age, similar gender. So comparability between background and release samples is very important. There may be naturally occurring hazardous substances, and that is particularly true for metals. So when you are sampling for metals, establishing a background concentration will be very important. Sometimes background sampling may not be possible. We use the example of an isolated pond. So if it's just an isolated pond on your site, it's very hard to find a background for that isolated pond. You'll have to discuss all of those conditions with your regional NPL coordinator if your site's really going forward strongly. And then there are very few instances in which background is not necessary, and that's if the substance is known to be present at the site based on previous analytical data, it is not known to occur naturally or to be ubiquitous in the environment, and there are no other sources of contamination for the substance identified in the vicinity of the site, so you're not in an industrialized area. We've talked about this a lot, what significance means. So if the background concentration is non-detect or less than the detection limit, you establish a release if the sample measurement equals or exceeds the sample quantitation limit, the SQL. And SQL is sensitive to the concentration of contaminants in the actual sample, and so that can be calculated on a sample-by-sample basis. If the background equals or exceeds the detection limit, a release is established if the sample measurement is at least three times the background concentration, and you can attribute that increase, at least in part, to your site. So some portion of the significant increase must be attributable to one or more sources at the site, and they've been looking at this at EPA headquarters a little more strongly in their QC. They told us that. In order to detect some of these contaminants, the closer you sample to your sources, the easier it will be to make a connection. Think about those transformation products. That may be something that is good for you to include transformation products. And if you can use a unique hazardous substance that is not found at other sites, you might want to do that to differentiate it if you are in an industrialized area or you have a ubiquitous chemical. So when release samples and target samples are evaluated, the EPA likes the data to be very strong, and so they want to make sure it's free from any sampling errors that may have been the result of the sampling team or any laboratory errors. There is a way to rescue biased data by applying adjustment factors. However, in our experience, most of the regions really like to have clean release data to count their targets. There's also a way to calculate an I or a J indices if you have multiple contaminants and no single one of them exceeds a benchmark. So you should think about doing that, and then know that if you're using high bias samples in order to calculate an I or a J indices, you can only do that at level 2 contamination. So we'll talk about all of these a lot more in the next two modules, but you really want to demonstrate that you have a release, your rigorous data quality, The SI guidance suggests 2 background samples for every three release samples, and that you need to think about attribution, especially if you have other sources, potential sources near your site, and then discuss the QAQC requirements with your regional coordinator to make sure that you are meeting all the QAQC. Phew. All right, so primary objectives for source sampling are to identify those sources and areas of observed contamination for the soil pathway, and then identify and attribute hazardous substances to the sources or to the site. Also, to demonstrate it released by chemical analysis for each of the pathways, you must be able to show that contamination is significantly above background and can be attributed to your site. All right. Any questions? Phew, 18 seconds over.
That's okay. We will take just a moment here with just one or two questions that have come in electronically. This first one is in reference to slide 7-45. And they just want to know, wouldn't you actually want to sample the impoundment in that example?
7-45. Oh, that, is that the map?
Yep, that's the example map, yeah.
The best idea is to sample the solids rather than if there are liquids in the impoundment, because the solids settle down and the hazardous substances all settle down and they concentrate in the sediment. So in this case, they're going for a sediment sample and then targeting what appears to be sludge from the electroplating process.
Okay. And it looks like we actually already addressed the other question that's in the queue. So if there's any other outstanding questions, now would be the time. I'll let you and Jody walk through some final reminders or some closing thoughts with the audience. We'll see if we get any more questions that kind of sneak in, and then we'll walk people through the final reminders before we end things today. So Therese or Jody, any final thoughts you want to leave the audience with?
Well, our next one is on Monday, this coming Monday at from 1 to 3 Eastern Time, and we'll go through the groundwater and the surface water pathway and talk more specifically about the SI sampling strategies.
Excellent. I don't see any other questions or comments. Jody, anything you want to leave the audience with?
No, just that I did, and Jean was nice enough to put a link up there that gives information about EPA's contract laboratory program. And it gives a list of who is a CLIP lab right now for you guys to take a look at and just get some more information.
Okay. Well, with that, let me go ahead and walk everybody through our closing reminders. I want to thank the nearly 100 people. Believe it or not, we did have 100 individuals who joined us from several states and actually a few countries for today's session. As we have already talked about, we are going to carry on with the webinar series with module number 8. This is a 9-part series, so if you haven't signed up for the last 2 modules in the series, please be sure to go ahead and do so at the page that you should see here. We have it if you go to cluin.org and you follow the links to our live training calendar. You can sign up for, again, Module 8, which will take place on July 28th, and the final module, Module number 9, will take place on July 30th. As we've mentioned in the past, we do have a live training record lookup system. So if you get to either our podcast listing or a live training calendar, you'll see links that appear towards the upper right of that page, and one of those will say My Participation Records. If you click that, it'll bring you to this page where you can enter your own email address, and then we'll send you an automated email that lists every single seminar that you've registered for or participated for using that particular email address. If you need additional information or are having other problems documenting your participation in our webinars, feel free to send an email to me at balance.jean@epa.gov. As we have mentioned with the others in the series, going too far. We do have the slides as well as the SI and PA guidance documents available to download as part of the resources or links page. You can certainly download those now. For those of you replaying the recorded version of this webinar, those links are currently active, so you'll see them under the middle right side of your page under related URLs. We are going to ask that everybody who joined us today to fill out that short feedback form online. Once you click the link to the seminar feedback form, it'll pop open a screen. Make sure your name and email address are entered correctly. They should auto-populate, but if they're not, feel free to correct. And then it'll walk you through a few basic questions about the session. We are asking participants to be sure to fill out the feedback form for each module in the series and make sure you check the box shown in red here. As long as your email address is entered correctly and that box is checked, we will send you an automated confirmation email. So if you're replaying the archive versions of these modules in the series, that'll help you verify or document that you did at least replay and submit feedback for that session. If you don't have time to fill out that form, you can come back to it. It is active from this point forward. So again, those of you replaying the recorded versions, you too can fill out the feedback form. I think that's the end, other than saying that we did record today's session. I'm going to work to get a temporary archive link posted as soon as I can. And again, if you're missing any of the other previously recorded modules, we do have links for modules 1 through 6 available. And I'll have module 7 up hopefully in just a few hours today. And you can play catch up over the next few days as we get ready to carry on with the series with module number 8 on July 28th. I want to thank both of our instructors from Tetra Tech for joining us today, and I hope that everybody who was able to participate found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and that we'll either see you or hear from you on our next session in the series. Again, Mod 8 will carry on July 28th. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.